I'm about to speak with Wally Chubot, once a radical Muslim Jew hater, now a lover of Jesus, who stands with Israel. He has a message for us today.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, these are some pretty radical book titles. Why I Left Jihad, The Root of Terrorism and the Return of Radical Islam. Why We Want to Kill You, The Jihadist Mindset and How to Defeat It. How about The Case for Islamophobia, Jihad by the Word, America's Final Warning. How about God's War on Terror, Islam Prophecy and the Bible? My guest, Wally Chubot, is the author of or co-author of these different books I mentioned, a man who was raised to hate the Jewish people in Israel and now is a staunch supporter of Israel with a word of warning for the West. Waleed, thanks so much for joining us on The Line of Fire today.
You bet, Mr. Brown. Thank you for having me.
Well, for those that don't know you, before we get to contemporary issues and things that you feel are important for America, where were you raised, and what did you think about the Jewish people in Israel growing up?
My mother was pregnant 9 months with myself. She married my father, who was Muslim in the U.S. She was visiting the Middle East in Bethlehem. I was born as soon as she arrived in Bethlehem, and I grew up, you know, with a mother who was not permitted to use her return ticket, so she was stuck for 34 years in the Middle East. It took years after I have been involved myself growing up in that environment, had been stoning worshippers at the Wailing Wall, you know, the very things that Palestinian youth do, graffiti on the walls, things evolved to demonstrating to hand-in-hand combats with the Israeli military, then ending up in the prison, being recruited in prison as a terrorist with Mahmoud al-Mughrabi and planting a bomb, although that became a controversy by CNN. They couldn't prove that I was never in prison. I was in prison. I was who I am. The State of Israel has never denounced who I was. And later on, of course, I came to the States to continue my studies. And the years, you know, joined the Muslim Brotherhood years later, I wanted to convert my wife to Islam. In that process, my wife asked me, basically, you know, if you think that the Bible has been corrupted, show me the corruptions in the Bible. I will be glad to become Muslim. So praise Allah, I said to myself. Studied the Bible, spent a year studying the scriptures, and I was fascinated with what I studied. And that became really the dynamo of my life. And later on became an advocate for Israel, spoke at universities, been in the media, and later on now we have Rescue Christians. We're rescuing suffering believers all over the Muslim world. And things, you know, grew tremendously as when I first made a promise to God that I will basically carry on whatever He wants me to do. And so here I am, still surviving, still working.
Yeah, quite an amazing story. Let's start here then as we begin to unfold this for our listeners. A few questions. We've got a break coming up. But here's what I want to ask you. Would you say, and we'll get into this when we come back, would you say that your experience just mirrored a certain radical faction of Islam and is not really representative of Islam in general? Would you say that the feelings you had towards Israel and the Jewish people are commonly held to by Muslims around the world? And then what this means for us in the West. So we'll take that all up when we come back. But the best website, if people want to find out what you're doing, Waleed, where should they go?
Shoebat.com, as you spell the word shoe, S-H-O-E, and bat, B-A-T, S-H-O-E-B-A-T.com.
All right, friends, we come back. I want to ask these questions about Islam. Was he just someone, Wally Chubot, just someone that got exposed to radical factions? Was Islam overall a religion of peace? Were his sentiments towards Israel typical of Muslims worldwide? And, you know, if the Bible is true, does that mean you're supposed to support Israel today? We'll be right back.
Change the world.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, but we'll often focus on issues having to do with Islam and the Middle East as well. And my guest, Waleed Shubat, feels that there are also very important issues regarding Mr. Obama's own family having to do with radical Islam, and I want to allow him to share those with you, our listening audience. If you have a question for my guest, we may get to some calls, 866-34-TRUTH. Waleed, what were you taught from your earliest days about the Jewish people and Israel? In your home, as a kid, in the schools, what did you grow up learning and thinking?
Well, the Islamic religion is not void of eschatological view. It's got its own set of eschatological view, which is the antithesis of the biblical view in eschatology, in which, if you look at the Zechariah chapters 12 and 14, as you may know, Christ will eventually come and rescue the Jewish people. And in the Islamic eschatological view, that the day of judgment shall not come to pass until the tribes of Islam come to defeat the tribes of Israel in Jerusalem and the surrounding nations. So there's the surrounding enemies of Israel right there in Islam, and this permeates the entire culture. It's not only the educational system, as many Jewish think tanks think that we need to change the Palestinian education system, but no, it's much further. It's the mosque system. It's the history ingrained. When I walked into a church when I first became a Christian, I was shocked at how much of the biblical eschatological view that's been kind of ignored. The Christians didn't know anything about the Hudaybiyah Treaty between Muhammad and how he basically entered into Mecca and began to expound after that, Umar ibn al-Khattab. You had asked the question, was it simply a peaceful form of Islam, or was there some sort of just a small group of fundamentalists? Was it a small group of fundamentalists that began wars with Christendom at that time in 636 AD when Islam had invaded and sent a message to Christian Emperor Heraclius they went into in Syria, the incursion continued into North Africa? Was it peaceful Islam when they had the Battle of Lepanto, the Battle of Poitiers, the Battle of Vienna to destroy Christendom even in Europe, even invading into Spain? So in other words, the Western thinking is void of this historical content that says Islam itself in its inception from the beginning of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, to the Sahaba, Umar ibn al-Khattab, Abu Bakr before him, of invasions to destroy Christendom, the entire 1040 window that we talk about, that the unwitnessed areas in the Middle East, that was all Christian nations. In other words, Islam came as an Arian heresy that denied the Father and the Son. And we look at the Bible itself. The four references regarding the Antichrist or the spirit of Antichrist is regarding the denial of the Father and the Son. So it's a Unitarian religion. It's a religion that is so focused and fighting strictly the Jews and the Christians. And this is very well described in the Quran, described in the history. In fact, I dare anybody to find me a Muslim scholar that would defy the history of Islam or defy Sharia. I've had debates with Muslim scholars. I've flown all over the place. And I've faced them. The first question I ask, are you willing to denounce Sharia? I haven't had a single Muslim scholar today tells me, yeah, I'm willing to denounce Sharia. That means amputation of hands, stoning of women, you name it. So in other words, the question is Islam has been hijacked, or is Islam from its inception violent? I go for the second. Islam is violent from its inception. It was not hijacked.
And what about the idea of Muhammad being the ideal man, the perfect model to follow? How does that tie in with violence and even the question of beheading?
Well, look, Islam has the alkaline and it has the acid reality. Okay, so you'll find verses that has alkalines, and those alkaline verses are usually
abrogated.
Yeah, okay. They've been abrogated. So the West does not understand the principles of an-nasikh wal-mansukh, what abrogates verses that calls for peace, like the verse of the sword in Surah 9 abrogates everything that calls for peace in the Quran. And so since the West is not aware of this, this is the methodology that is used. In fact, Muhammad used the same methodology on the Jews in Saudi Arabia. In fact, even the Muslim Brotherhood planned, under the spiritual leader of Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, says that we need to go back to the Meccan era in which Muhammad used that kind of system. This is why they have what is called Muruna. I know many in the West understand Taqiyya, but there is another side to it. Taqiyya is a Shiite concept. But the Muruna concept comes from the Muslim Brotherhood, which says that Islam can sanction prohibitions, i.e., Muslim can do anything, even murdering, even killing. Even a Muslim girl like Huma Abedin marrying Anthony Weiner, who's a Jew, is permissible in Islam. In fact, Huma Abedin, as it turned out, wasn't simply a Muslim Brotherhood member, but a Muslim Brotherhood leader. And we have established tremendous documentation on that issue, which Michelle Bachmann took to the White House, and she got a black eye as a result. She was attacked by McCain to argue of the infiltration of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States.
How is it then that our State Department, as the Muslim Brotherhood was rising in Egypt, basically said these are good guys and not involved in terror? Was that just sheer duplicity from our State Department?
Well, the State Department has always betrayed the American people and the Jewish people. If you look historically, it was George Marshall who basically objected about the establishment of the State of Israel. Thank God the president had a dream, and in that dream he saw the Jewish people in the ovens, being killed in the ovens, and he went against George Marshall, and the United States ended up supporting the State of Israel. So history repeats itself. When it comes to the State Department, it's always been a traitor. Now, I do not know why. It's not duplicity. It's not just simply being naivete. But when we come to the liberal movement, I mean, this is something very important to understand. Islam is not a conservative religion. Keith Ellison is not conservative. He swore on the Quran. All his policies is very liberal. Al Gore compliments Islam, hates Christianity. The president of the United States, if you look at YouTube, you know, he talks about the Bible. He really condemns the Bible, says the Bible teaches slavery. But yet when it comes to the Quran, the Holy Quran says. So in other words, the liberal movement, they have much in common, because Islam itself doesn't believe that life begins at the moment of conception as we do. Life has a gestation period. Well, this tickles the ears of the abortionists. You know, Al Gore talks about Islamic himaz, in other words, environmental protectorates in Islam. And that, you know, he compliments Islam very much. Islam has what it's called al-ishtirakiyya al-islamiyya, which means spreading the wealth. As Muhammad, when he moved from his people, moved from Mecca to Medina, the story of al-muhajirun wal-ansar, when they moved to Medina, they were aided by Muslims in Medina who shared the wealth. So Islam has the concept of socialism. Islam talks about the Big Bang Theory. All the Muslim talkers in the U.S. or the slick willies in the universities say that the Quran teaches the Big Bang, and that is in the Quran. So this tickles the ears of the, evolutionists. So it is not as many think. It is theistic evolution that Islam believes in a modern way. So basically, the idea of the liberals in the West is really a war against Christianity. That's the bottom line. And the Muslim Brotherhood has stated it in their documents very clearly that we will use the entities that sympathize with our cause, i.e. the liberal movement. You look at Jimmy Carter. He was against the Shah of Iran. What happened? The Khomeini came from France, parked in Iran. We had the revolution of Iran, the first Islamic revolution, a thing we're still dealing with. Now we have the whole nuclear issue. Has just evolved tremendously.
So just 1 minute before our next break, but when Operation Cast Lead was taking place and Israel was going after Hamas terrorists in Gaza, there were coalitions against Israel's actions here in America. There were some on the streets shouting, Jews need to go back to the ovens. But what I noticed was that some of the coalitions also had feminists and gay activists, the very ones who could actually march the streets of Israel and even have a gay pride event, I'm sorry to say, in Israel. But if they're in Gaza, they'd be killed. Is it a spiritual blindness, a demonic thing that unites people like this against Israel in such an irrational way?
That's a very interesting question, very interesting point, because you look at every anti-Israel demonstration. Who's holding hands? Socialists, communists, extremists, gays and lesbians. It's obvious that evil always will unite with itself against what is good. You know, it's always, the, you know, these institutions condemn Israel for defending itself. It's like a cop who's cleaning the drug problem in the neighborhood, and if he has to shoot a drug pusher in a fire combat, they don't look at the issue of what was the reason or what was the intent of the officer in the same case. Israel, what is his intent from bombing Hamas? Because Hamas lobs Qassam rockets. You have also Hezbollah had lobbed, you know, rockets at Israel tremendously. In fact, this reminds me, in Joel.
I'll tell you what, yeah, let's just jump in here. We come back. Let's ask, does America have anything to be concerned about in terms of Islam? I'm going to let my guest speak freely, and then we'll evaluate what he has to say. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to The Line of Fire today. My guest, Waleed Shubat, his website, shubat.com, S-H-O-E-B-A-T. He has referred to terrorist activities he was involved with before becoming a Christian. You can go to his website, and he will take on the challenges where people have said he's made this up, this is not true, this is not accurate. He has dealt with these issues, and you can go to his website and review his responses to those charges. Waleed, as the author or co-author of books with titles like The Case for Islamophobia, Jihad by the Word, America's Final Warning, look, we have all kinds of conspiratorial theories here in America, and everybody's telling us, watch out for this one, or that, or it's all the Masons, or it's all the Illuminati, or this or that. Convince us that you're not just another fearmonger, and that there is a warning for America with Islam. Right. Go ahead. Speak freely.
Yes. I mean, I am totally against those notions. I do not like the conspiracy theories. I do not like what Alex Jones talks about. I strictly focus on fact. Everything we say has to be backed up by fact. It was President Obama. Fact. Spoke in Egypt and basically had the red carpet for the Muslim Brotherhood when the government
and by the way, even used a phrase like when the Quran was revealed, which speaks of a certain
correct.
Bias. But go ahead.
And he kept giving quotes in the Quran and everything else, and he gave the green light for the Muslim Brotherhood to begin its movement. It was the United States under President Obama who began the incursions into Libya, into Iraq, and into also Syria. The situation of the Christians in Syria is dire. And it's not just only the Democrats, but also somebody in the Republican, like, you know, John McCain and others, mm-hmm. who basically advocated such issues. So it was the United States, no question, that basically even the best experts in the world will say the United States have worked tirelessly into advancing even Turkey. Turkey was a secular nation, and our relationship with Turkey is very good today, even though they aspire Islamic causes, even though they're housing the Muslim Brotherhood who are fleeing from Egypt. So basically infusing Egypt and allowing the Mursi and allowing the Muslim Brotherhood to be victorious in Egypt, causing havoc in Egypt, which is very detrimental for the state of Israel. And so, you know, not only President Obama, but his entire family. In fact, it is known fact that his brother Malik Obama is a executive director of the Islamic Da'wah organization, an affiliation that deals with the Union of Good. Union of Good has been designated by the U.S. Treasury as terror entity. In other words, financing terrorism. In fact, President Obama's brother has a keffiyeh. We have provided the photo with Hamas keffiyeh. On it has the flag of Palestine, from the river to the sea, it says. Mm-hmm. In other words, there is no state of Israel. On it, it says in the Arabic, Al-Quds lana, Jerusalem is ours. We will be marching forth. Innana qadimun, in the Arabic language. This speaks volumes. And if executive order, presidential executive order, 13224 established what Malik Obama, President Obama's brother, does, is a terror entity who works for the government of Sudan. His boss was Siwar Dahab. We have established with video in which he basically spoke for Hamas with Ismail Haniyeh and have given speeches as we are coming and marching towards Jerusalem. You know, he was in an event alongside with the head of the IHH, who basically had sent a flotilla to Israel. So we're dealing with a family that is notoriously Muslim fundamentalist, including President Obama himself is very much inclined with his family, and they've been best man at each other's weddings. Malik Obama's his older brother, even the grandmother herself, you know, Mama Sara, they raise funds. They have a 501c3, which was retroactivated to Malik Obama by Lewis Lerner illegally. So in other words, he's got connections with the state, with the U.S. Treasury, in which he can illegally run an operation that supports the Muslim Brotherhood, that supports the Islamic movement. In fact, even his cousin, Musa Ismail Obama, we have the recordings on Al Jazeera television in which he talked about how the U.S. funds of the Barack H. Obama Foundation is money that they spend to recruit Muslims to go from Africa into the three top most virulent Wahhabi schools in Saudi Arabia. One of them is Umm al-Qura University, which was founded by Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, the father of Wahhabism. You know, all these are documented. We have the photos of the billboards he runs in Kogelo, Kenya, in which he uses the Barack H. Obama Foundation, as well as WAMI, which is the World Union for Muslim Youth, another entity that's identified by the State of Israel. We have the reports, we have the terrorism reports, official reports from the State of Israel, showing how these organizations fund Hamas. We have a litany of websites all over the world in which it directly links to President Obama's brother organization, which is the Islamic Dawah organization, how you can fund Hamas, send monies to Hamas. This is fact. This is no fiction. So in other words, the entire family are in bed with the Wahhabists, with the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, it was President Obama himself who twisted the arm of Kair Silva of Southern Sudan because he wanted to basically thwart and finally remove Omar al-Bashir, Malik Obama's boss, from Sudan. It was President Obama who intervened and twisted his arm in a very mean-spirited conversation with him, telling him that he should not retaliate against North Sudan. So we're talking about persecution of Christians in Syria, in Sudan, in Iraq, and there's nothing being done about the persecution of believers. Let's not forget what our Lord said in Matthew 25, "For I was hungry, you gave me no food, right. I was naked." You know, those things are very crucial to Christians. We sit here in America. Sorry.
No, go ahead. Just take a couple more seconds. Go ahead.
Yeah, we talk about prophecy, yet we are all prophecy buffs, but we don't think about the suffering Christian. We have
right.
to think
about the here and now. We can debate about coming tribulation, but what about the horrific tribulation here and now? Right. That leads to an important question. Do Christians fight back? What is the right posture? Is it time for Christian armies and Christian self-defense, or does that take us away from the spirit of the cross? An important question we'll take up as soon as we come back. And if you feel that you have factual information to rebut what my guest has said, contact us at info@askdrbrown.org. I wanted to give Wally the opportunity to lay out his case. If you feel he's making this all up, he's delusional, well, by all means, contact us at info@askdrbrown.org. If you are a scholar in the field, feel he can rebut, you can rebut him, I'm sure. He'll be very happy to discuss it and take you on. And friends, you know we are on the front lines of helping the church to understand God's purposes for Israel and reaching out with the gospel to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. A couple years ago, I debated my friend Rabbi Shmuley Boteach on the issue of homosexuality, one of the most fascinating debates we've done. I also did a debate a few years before that with a gay activist who claimed to be a born-again Christian. I want to send you these two debates as a gift for your gift of any size. We'll send them out to you on DVD. Stand with us today. Would you do that? 1-800-278-9978. This is by phone only, so you need to call 1-800-278-9978. Thanks for your generosity. Together, we're making a difference.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
My special guest today, Waleed Shoebat. His website, Shoebat, S-H-O-E-B-A-T, Shoebat.com. He's not afraid to tackle controversial issues. It's somewhat miraculous that he's still alive with the number of people who hate him, would not like to see him alive. I'm involved in a lot of controversy day and night myself, but I would say that legitimate death threats that have come my way are few and far between, if any. It would be the opposite with my guest. I'm not going to be taking calls, but I do want to discuss a number more important issues. Waleed, before we get back to the issue of persecution of Christians and the question that your son Ted has addressed in words that some are concerned about in terms of the force or the rhetoric, so we'll come back to those issues. But as followers of Jesus, we want to share the good news. We want to evangelize. We want to make disciples of the nations. We want to spread the faith. Well, Muslims in that sense are evangelistic. They want to spread the faith. But of course, Islam does not primarily mean peace, but submission. What would be the primary difference in the mindset of a Muslim who wants to spread his faith around the world and the mindset of a follower of Jesus who wants to spread his or her faith around the world?
Well, you know, Islam is the antithesis of Christianity. Islam is an aggressive warfare that's been commanded by the Prophet of Islam. Muhammad himself stated, "Umirtu an uqatila an-nasa hatta yaqulu la ilaha illallah Muhammadan Rasulullah." I have been ordered to fight all the nations until everyone say there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger. Our faith is not an aggressive faith. It's a defensive faith. This is why I argue with my American compatriots that they keep talking about turning the other cheek. Now, are you married, Mr. Brown?
Yes, I am. Grandfather. Father and grandfather.
Grandfather. Praise God. Yeah. If somebody comes into your window and is going to harm your children or your grandchildren, would you not shoot that intruder and protect your family?
Right. Obviously, if someone broke into our house, our kids are out of the house, but let's say when the kids were in the house, if they broke in, I wouldn't say, well, Jesus taught me to turn the other cheek, and therefore, here's where the kids are, here's where my wife is. I would do what I needed to do to stop them, do my best to preserve life, but do what I could to do to stop them. I would obviously make a distinction between that and persecution for the faith. In other words, if someone came...
They came to kill you because you're Christian. They came to harm you because you're Christian. They came to rape your wife. Trust me, you would shoot first and you'd insist your wife cleans the mess afterwards. That's the case. In Syria, you take, let's say, the Lions of the Cherubim, a group of Christians who decided to defend their church. They have killed 60 terrorists invading that church. You can look it up. The Lions of the Cherubim. Other Christians in Syria chose the route of suffering, and what happened, you know, the entire country is nearly void of Christians. They've been persecuted so badly. Women were raped and all these things. So I think there's a decisive moment we have to say that defensive mechanism is obligatory. You know, Christ himself said, you know, the most beautiful thing is for somebody to die for their friends. How do you die for your friends? Do you commit suicide or do you put your life on the line in defensive way? So you can, you know, so you can defend them, and if you survive, fine. If you die, then you've died for your friend as a martyr. So Christianity is not void of martyrdom, you know.
Yeah, but all right. Well, tell you what, we're into this now. We've got a short break and then an extended segment. If the government came to arrest me because I was a follower of Jesus, or if Jewish extremists came to attack me, I would not shoot to kill. I wouldn't even think of that. If that had been the mindset of Christians through the centuries, we wouldn't have been martyred for the faith. But you raise a question. What happens when you have national attack? What happens when you have these atrocities committed? Do you flee? What's the right response? So I do want to talk about this. Plainly, people's lives are at stake. These are not theoretical issues. So I'll continue with this with my guest, Waleed Shoebat, as soon as we come back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right, this is a very critically important discussion that I'm having with my guest, Wally Schubat. Again, his website, S-H-O-E, as in shoe, and bat, schubat.com. Wally, let me first say that I'm 100% with you in raising concern and sounding the alarm about the atrocities being committed against Christians around the world, and they're primarily being committed by Muslims, be it in Syria, be it in Egypt, be it in Nigeria, northern Nigeria, other parts of the world. And it always grieves me when I'll have Christian friends who are really concerned about a human rights violation in Israel, which, if you boil it down, is a pretty minor thing compared to people being slaughtered by the thousands. What the death toll, 140,000 plus in Syria, with horrific atrocities being committed against the Christian community there. What's happened in Iraq, with as evil as Saddam Hussein was, there was still a controlling presence he had in terms of liberty for Christians. Now, large percentage of the population, or a certain percentage, has fled. Thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands killed or displaced. So I'm totally with you in terms of raising the urgency of this situation. But let's talk this through. So I don't want to downplay that. I've been spat on in the face by, you know, hostile person I was witnessing to, or others who threatened me. I was preaching in India, and radical Hindus took over the stage with knives and razor blades in our hand. Well, I didn't spit back, didn't fight back, got off the stage, and I thought we may get hit, we may get hurt, but it never occurred to the Indian brothers there, one of whom's been stoned, others have been martyred, that we were supposed to physically fight back or resist. And we know Jesus says, if you're persecuted in one city, flee to another. Paul says, if your enemy is hungry, feed him, overcome evil with good, etc. We know the problem of holy war mentality. When Christians have taken on holy war mentality, we know in the Crusades, all the Jews gathered together in the great synagogue of Jerusalem and burned to the ground as Christians marched around it, singing, Christ, we adore thee. So as a Jewish follower of Jesus in particular, I'm sensitive to calls for, quote, holy war, and always explain the revolution that we're talking about is one of overcoming evil with good, overcoming hatred with love. That's one thing. But now we're looking at it on a national level, and I guess the question would be, if we knew as Americans that Muslims, let's say they were Taliban or they were Al-Qaeda, they were bombing and attacking a Christian community, and we had military there, we would probably all support bombing them, but we'd somehow separate that from our faith. So I'm being totally candid with you. I have concerns about some of the language, but I know these are complex issues. So over to
you. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about you being spat on in India. We're not talking about, let's say, the Jews who got burned by the Crusader. You know, that's another issue. In fact, even the burning was carried out by Crusader followers. It wasn't orders from the headquarters. So that's a different discussion.
Yeah, there was a rabble there involved in it. I understand that.
We both agree that was evil. But what wasn't evil was really protecting Jerusalem from the invading armies of Islam. This part of the Crusader Wars that I agree with. But that's not the subject of today. The subject of today is militarism, in other words, national level. The question, you know, like when Christians witness to Muslims, I watched them when I first became Christian. They sit there and apologize about the warfare that happened in Europe. I mean, if it wasn't for the battles of Lepanto, Vienna, and Poitiers, all Europe would have been Islamized just as we have in Turkey. So no one can say that Christendom could not defend itself in the Battle of Tours, of Poitiers. Without that, the whole world would have been Islamized. So you cannot argue and say that was a wrong war. In fact, many Protestants stood with the Muslims in those wars, and especially the Battle of Lepanto. Let's not forget history. And so this mentality of no war whatsoever is really a mistake, because here's the question. You know, when Christian apologizes about the Crusades, about the warfare and all these things, they don't really apologize completely, because it is forbidden for the Christians to war in the Middle East, but it's not forbidden for Israel to fight in the Six Days War. Can you tell me emphatically Israel was wrong to fight in the Six Days War? They had a war. And that was a godly war. And God ordained that war. It was fought in 6 days. It paralleled the Battle of Joshua. On the seventh day, early in the morning, the children of Israel arose, went around the walls of Jericho 7 times. It was a 6 days war for Joshua. In fact, it was a 6 days war in the Battle of Poitiers as well, in which the French charged Martel. Martel means the hammer. You know, it sounds like another repetition of Maccabi. So, in other words, Christendom continued with the warfare idea. And this is something I do agree with my Catholic brethren and my Orthodox brethren, in which that part of history of Christianity is legitimate. We fought World War I. We fought World War II. It's okay for us in America to fight the enemies, Japan, who believed the emperor was God and believed in such heresies that we finally bombed them with nuclear weapons. It's okay for us, but it's not okay for the Christians in Syria to fight. It's not okay for the Christians in Africa to fight, to defend themselves. What kind
So here's the question, and again, that's why we're having this discussion as candidly as possible. How does one draw the line? And by the way, I agree that there is such a thing as a just war. I agree with defensive wars. I'm glad that that America and the Allies were able to destroy Nazism. Of course, no question about it. But human nature being what it is, how do you avoid now the counter-terrorist mentality? How do you avoid now, okay, if we can be preemptive and kill these people here, then they won't be able to get to us in 10 or 20 years. How do you ultimately overcome evil with good? How do you ultimately forgive persecutors and pray for them? While, yes, let's say on a national level, defending ourselves, look, we have police and things like that. And I would have no problem if some, you know, a bunch of hooligans were attacking my house, I'd call the police. I'd have no problem. And if they said, we're attacking your house because we hate you, you're a Christian, I'd still have no problem calling the police. But how do we avoid the wrong attitudes, the attitudes of now hatred and vengeance? And now we just become a counter-terrorist violent organization because, you know, it's human nature to do these kinds of things.
Right. Right, we must also understand that we are obligatory as Christians to obey our government. You know, render unto God what is God's, what is Caesar to Caesar's. But we keep forgetting rendering unto God what is God's. Government has certain limits. The government can't tell me I cannot worship Jesus, I cannot worship in a church, I cannot worship in a synagogue. You know, if that comes to that, if they say, you know, you cannot worship no more, they begin to persecute Christians, then we have to go underground, we have to basically begin to combat the government in ways and speaking out and suffering, and martyrdom basically is the water of the faith.
Yes.
I am talking about defensive mechanism in which we could work through our governments to defend Christians all over the world.
Right.
So, you know, we can't divorce the government. The government is involved. The problem is not the government. The problem is the people. The problem in America is that Americans, especially the Christians, have become lazy. You go to church lately, what are they talking about these days? They should be marching in the White House regarding the persecution of what's going on in the Christian world. Yet they're doing nothing. What is going on is absolutely watered-down faith, the essence of our faith to defend what is God's. You know, Christ's purpose for coming to earth was what? People say he came to save us. Well, yes, that's true. But the purpose for Christ's coming is in John. You know, Christ came to what? Destroy the works of the devil. So how do we destroy the works of the devil? Doesn't mean we carry guns. No, it means we destroy the works of the devil by participating in the political system, by speaking out and by being a strong voice in this nation to basically change the government that we live under so they can begin to carry out policies that are favorable to the Christians. Look, the gay movement, they don't undermine their goals. They go full throttle on their goals. Yet what do we do with the gay movement here? We simply become wishy-washy, you know, a Christian can be gay at the same time, a pastor can be gay. Well, this is nonsense. This is not, you know, this is not Christianity.
Right.
In other words, the watering of Christianity is the problem in the United States.
Yeah, absolutely, no question. It's self-centered, it's all about me, it's how I can have a better, more comfortable life. Jesus calls me not to take up the cross, but to be empowered by the cross for self-fulfillment. Of course. And I've been sounding the alarm about that for decades myself. And I want to say again, while I wanted to draw attention to concerns I had about certain words used or rhetoric or a call for a holy war or something like that, I absolutely I'm standing side by side in terms of saying we must raise our voices. We must call for government action. We must ask why all the attention on, say, Israeli settlements in the West Bank and not commensurate attention to the atrocities going on. If you ask your average American Christian, who is Boko Haram, they've never heard of them. And yet these are brothers and sisters in Nigeria being slaughtered by these Muslim terrorists, Boko Haram. All right, we come back one last segment with my guest. And again, I want to ask plainly, why does America have to be concerned about Islam here on our soil? And if I have a chance, I have an Israel-related question as well. Again, the website, shoebat.com, S-H-O-E-B-A-T.com.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks, friends, for joining us today on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday as we focus on issues related to Islam with my guest, Waleed Shoebat. Waleed, I wish we had several hours to talk. I appreciate you giving us an hour. I know that your schedule is very intense. One of my favorite lines from you is that you were a Jordanian one day and woke up the next day you were a Palestinian. You're saying growing up as a boy, you did not have the consciousness of I'm part of the Palestinian people?
That's correct. We were proud Jordanian. In fact, the PNC, Palestinian National Council, never demanded to create a Palestinian state in the West Bank. It continued all the way till the 80s. Demanding to basically unite the East Bank with the West Bank, in other words, joining the West Bank back to Jordan. It was later on, you could look at history, it's always been that the Palestinians want to establish a state where Israel exists, period. And before 1967, they wanted to establish a Palestinian state in Israel proper. After 1967, they wanted to establish it in the West Bank. And, you know, it's been always the call for Palestinians to annihilate Israel. This hasn't changed. So Hamas wants to annihilate Israel. Now they're making a state within a state with Gaza. You have Hamasistan. You have also in the West Bank, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PA, has always basically supported the idea of terrorism against Israel. So this is not a call for establishing a state. It's not a state that we were looking for. It is a state without Jews. That is exactly what we aspired from the beginning. That is the call of the Palestinian cause. There's never been a demand to establish a Palestinian state. By what right? In all the last 2,000 years, how many years did the Arabs rule the land they call Palestine? Less than 100 years. It was the Ottomans, it was the Mamluks, it was the Crusades, it was the English. So by what right do you want to establish an Arab state? It never existed as an Arab state for less than 100 years. And for 3,000 years, it's been a Jewish state. Jerusalem has always been the focal point of the Jews who are not allowed to go on to pray on the Temple Mount. What if the Muslims got robbed, got taken over, and Mecca all of a sudden was taken over by the Crusades? Will anybody argue that Muslims have no right to Mecca and the Kaaba itself? Now, imagine if the Jews took over the Al-Kaaba, and now they have the Al-Kaaba with the Jewish writings all around it, with that, you know, the tarp they put on it. And no Muslim is allowed to enter that land. Do you think that will be tolerated? Yet a Jew is not allowed to set foot on the Temple Mount. Ariel Sharon, when he set foot in the Temple Mount, everybody was screaming, huffing and puffing and yelling. You know, why can't a Jew have a right to enter into the Temple Mount? He should have a right. That is the Solomon Temple. That's historically been proven fact. Belongs to the Jewish people. So in other words, it's the ignorance of history is the problem.
Yeah, and in fact, when there are negotiations and discussions, Palestinian authorities made it plain that they do not want Jews in a Palestinian state, whereas you have 1.5 million Arabs living in Israel proper, and those Arabs do not want to be under Palestinian rule either. I'm sure you've heard the charge that with the erecting of the security fence, it's now destroying Christianity in Bethel and in Bethlehem, and the Christ at the checkpoint conferences talking about all the evils perpetrated by Israel against the Palestinians. I mean, I look at the wider issue of Islam trying to snuff out Christianity in the Middle East, and what happened with Palestinian Authority in Bethlehem before that. How do you react as a former Muslim and as a man born in this region when you hear these kinds of charges or hear about a Christ at the Checkpoint conference? How do you react as a Christian now?
Well, I look at the Bethlehem Bible College. I'm very familiar with Bashar Awad and all these guys who I have their own testimonies. They supported Hamas. They, in fact, Bashar Awad spoke in a church in Hawaii when he says that we need to support the existence of Hamas. Hello, this is a group that supports Hamas. We have to examine the Arabic language. I was one of the first in the country to basically begin to take the Arabic language of what these people say in the Arabic, translate it to the English, and the results are astonishing if you look at the researches in which these people are pro-Hamas. In other words, they think that Hamas can be moderated. They want to unite Hamas with Fatah. They are pro-PFLP. Graduates from Bethlehem Bible College who support the Checkpoint. I have their testimonies, their writings in which they supported PFLP, the Popular Front to Liberate Palestine, so-called Christian George Habash, who is really a communist in disguise and who was a terrorist who killed civilians in Israel. This is the group that deals with this. They go to Iran, they meet with the Iranian revolution, so on and so forth. We are dealing with a terrorist entity that has a facade of calling itself Baptist Christians and running a Bethlehem Bible College and doing the Checkpoint and everything else, when in reality they're pro-terrorism. In fact, all the major Catholic leaders in the Palestinian arena have been proven to have supported terrorism. In fact, Ilarion Capucci was a friend of our family. He was smuggling explosives. This is a major Catholic archbishop, smuggling in the 70s explosives into the state of Israel and, you know, causing havoc in the state of Israel. In other words, it's not just to support terrorism, but religiously they support the killing of Jews actually by supporting terrorism through material means and explosives and everything else. You know, so we need to understand that not everybody who calls themselves Christians in the Middle East is Christian. This is basically a very strange theology they believe. Here Jesus is depicted surrounded by barbed wire in their artwork, and basically he's being persecuted by the Jewish people. Excuse me, it was the Israeli military that rescued the Church of the Nativity where Christ was born. It was the State of Israel with its military who took out the terrorists. In fact, even the Vatican supported these terrorists and sent them all over the place. So, you know, we're dealing with an entity that is pro-terrorism. The Arab Catholic and the Arab Orthodox has always been on the forefront of trying to influence the Vatican into making it pro-Palestine and not pro-Israel. So we have a major problem, and that is the religious leaders. In fact, how many Christians live in Palestine today? In Israel proper, the ratio of Christians has never changed. In Palestine proper, the ratio of Christians has diminished.
The question is, what's the difference there? I'm looking at the clock. I'm out of time, which means, folks, if you want to hear Waleed Shubat's warnings to America, you need to read his books. Go to shubat.com, shoebat.com. And friends, if you're involved with Christ at the Checkpoint or Bethlehem Bible College and you want to come on the air with me and discuss these issues, wonderful. Or better yet, invite one of us to speak at the conference next year. Waleed, I wish we had more time. I appreciate your courageous stand, and I hope that America will wake up in time. May God's grace be yours. Thank you, sir.
God's grace be upon you as well, brother.
All right. Friends, I know we generated many issues that could be considered very controversial. If you take issue with them, call me. We've got an open talk radio broadcast, or write to our website, info@askdrbrown.org. All right, stand with us. If you appreciate what we're doing on radio and know that we are making a difference, your gift of any size to help us on the front lines, I want to send you two DVDs, Debating an Orthodox Rabbi, A Man Who Claims to Be a Born Again Gay Christian. Eye-opening DVDs, $40 retail value, yours for your gift of any size. Call 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. My bottom line today, we have no excuse not to know who and what Islam is. So what about the dietary laws? Are these things just good to follow for us as believers? Are they mandatory for believers, for Jews, for Gentiles who believe in Jesus? What does the Word say?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast on the Line of Fire. I just had a very intense interview with Waleed Shubat in the last hour. We covered a lot of controversial issues. He is passionate. He has a tremendous amount to say. And you cannot be indifferent to what he has to say. So I encourage you to listen to that interview. You'll be able to do so later today by going to my website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. But we're changing subjects now. We are completely changing gear. And we are shifting gear, changing subjects, shifting gear. We're talking about the dietary laws. We're going to have a fun and friendly debate on the Line of Fire today. Here's the number to call, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. The dietary laws laid out in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. We're not talking about later rabbinic developments to the point that you cannot eat dairy products and meat products together. There must be a period of X number of hours between them to the point that in a very traditional home, you'll have different utensils that are used for dairy versus for meat. We're not talking about those later distinctions. We are talking about the dietary laws as best as we can understand them in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. There is some debate and dispute in terms of what the some of the animals are, but certainly there is overall agreement on things like pork products and lobster, shellfish, different things, that those are forbidden under Old Testament law. How do these apply to believers today? How do these apply to believers today? Are they still binding on believers today? Does God require all believers, Jew and Gentile, to live by the dietary laws today? And if we don't, are we in some level of sin or disobedience? Or is it just obligatory for Jewish believers as part of the Torah covenant, but not for Gentile believers? Or is it wrong to think that it's obligatory for any today, perhaps good for health purposes, but not obligatory in any way? Should we even care about this? 866-34-TRUTH. Now, sometimes when we have a debate about a subject, a controversial subject, I won't give you my view until the end. But I'm going to do the reverse today. In my personal life, it's not an issue. The only time pork product of any kind might pass my lips would be if I was having wonton soup in a Chinese restaurant and it wasn't chicken wonton soup. But that's utterly irrelevant to me in terms of my lifestyle. I've never been a pork eater. I don't eat pepperoni pizza. I don't eat pork meat, you know, any kind of pork sandwich meat, anything like that. I've never been an eater of lobster, or shrimp, or anything like that. So on a personal level, it's a non-issue in my life, all right? However, I do not believe that the New Testament in any way makes the dietary laws obligatory for believers today, Jewish or Gentile. I have many Jewish friends who feel it's part of covenantal identification with our people. So be it. Wonderful. I understand that. I have no argument with that and affirm that in many ways. Is it obligatory? I say, based on the full revelation of Scripture in the New Testament, it is not obligatory. The dietary laws were there to teach certain separation purposes and, especially for Gentile believers, have never been given in a mandatory way. And we have no business telling people they are obligated to keep the dietary laws today. You can agree, you can disagree. The phone lines are open. Let's have at it. 866-34-TRUTH.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Now look, it's true. It's true. I've had friends, Jewish friends, that came to faith. And when they came to faith, they were given a ham sandwich to prove that they were genuine believers. That's idiotic and ridiculous. In fact, in a lesser way, it reminds me of some of the horrors that took place with medieval baptisms of Jews to Catholicism, where part of the baptismal formula, they would have to renounce, or part of their confession, they would have to renounce any attachment to the Jewish people, and they would even have to say that they would develop a taste for pig products. Horrific. Horrific. So I am not one that is advocating testing someone's spirituality by whether they eat pork products or whether they eat lobster or shrimp. No, no, God forbid. And people are free to eat and free not to eat. They are free to have convictions, and we need to honor one another's personal convictions. But I see no possible way, based on the understanding that what we eat does not defile us spiritually, although Jesus was not abolishing the dietary laws and teaching that in Mark 7. I'll get back to that passage in a little while, the parallel in Matthew 15. He was giving us a principle by which we understand. Let's say you're out in the mission field and you're reaching out to someone, and they serve you a pig, and that's their delicacy that they're serving you, that this is only for a special feast and you're a special guest, and you know if you don't eat it, you're going to lose them. You better eat that. You better eat that and understand it's not going to defile you by eating it, because what you eat physically will not defile you spiritually. And Paul makes clear in Romans 14 that nothing in and of itself is unclean, and that this matter in terms of foods eaten, this is something that is convictional. And on top of that, there is not a stitch of evidence anywhere in the New Testament where God laid certain Old Testament laws on Gentile believers. And if you want to argue for it, I'll show any of you that you're not living by it in any stretch of the imagination in terms of all of Old Testament law that could potentially be kept today. Are people free to have convictions that, hey, if God gave us these laws, there's a good reason for it, and therefore we want to abstain? Go for it. You know, I feel personally convicted by the Lord. I should not eat these things. Great. I'm a Jewish believer, and I feel it's important covenantally to remain in solidarity with my people. Great. That is different than obligatory. That's where I have my issue, especially when it is laid on non-Jewish believers. 866-34-TRUTH. The question again is, can you make a case for the dietary laws being obligatory on all followers of Jesus Yeshua today? We'll start in Cave City, Kentucky. Renee, thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Michael Brown.
Hello.
Enjoy your show immensely.
My question is,
I've just really been listening to you a lot. I kind of keep you on my iPhone listening to you every day and enjoy the show a lot. From the study that I have studied the last several years, the concept of when someone would join themselves to an Israelite, God would give the instruction that the sojourner or those that would journey along would have one law. And if that was the concept of the Old Testament, why is there such a distinction? Well, is the identify of the Israelite today versus the Gentile of today, if it's one God with one Messiah and one body, why would he make a diversity in law? I don't understand that.
Well, he's not. We all follow the law of the Messiah today. We're all part of the new covenant. Remember, in Old Testament times, to be part of the people of God would have meant joining yourself to the nation of Israel. And if you wanted full status, would actually mean conversion to becoming a Jewish person and a full-fledged Israelite. This would have been the case in Jesus' day. If you were a Gentile, You could worship at the synagogue, you could follow certain basic moral laws, but you were not considered a Jew or an Israelite. If, however, you converted and became a Jew, then you would have full status, and you could even pray the prayers, God of our fathers, as if these were now your fathers. And now with the coming of the gospel, there's no distinction made between Jew and Gentile in terms of salvation. Acts, the 15th chapter, the question came up, did Gentiles need to become Jews and follow the Torah in order to be saved? And the answer was no. We're all saved by grace, and this was never a yoke that God intended to put on the Gentile world. And so when they had the opportunity to make it mandatory, they didn't. Paul fought it tooth and nail when the Galatians were told, unless you were circumcised and obey the law of Moses, you're not saved. He fought that tooth and nail and told the Galatians not to lose the freedom that they had in the Messiah. If you were to consistently live this out, Renee, it would mean that you're celebrating every new moon. It would mean that as a woman, you'd have to live by certain purity laws and separation, a physical separation from your husband during certain times of the month. It would mean if your husband had a brother and this brother was married but died without having children, then your husband would be obligated or expected to marry also the sister. So there'd be a polygamous setting there so that there could be children born in his name. It would mean that we'd be stoning adulterers and burning witches, etc. So obviously we're not saying people have to live by Old Testament law today. We're saying that there is a new law in the Messiah, and this is what unites us. And Jews may have certain convictions to live by as believers and Gentiles others, but we have oneness in Jesus because this is not what defines us. What defines us is being in him. And that's the change from the Sinai covenant to the new covenant.
So the distinction with, there's a lot of people teaching the one law principle now. So that's just, I guess, a doctrinal statement that some are making versus others.
And I would say it's absolutely unscriptural. And I would say it's one that leads people into a lot of bondage and confusion. And I've actually watched people who are Gentile Christians who love Jesus come into this to the point that they're utterly confused about who he is. Some have even now denied the faith and converted to Judaism. So Yeshua Jesus must be central in all, and I would strongly disagree with the one law principle for today. Even a group like First Fruits for Zion, which strongly advocates Jewish believers living by Torah in light of the new covenant, they used to teach this and have since separated from it. But Renee, thank you very much for the call. We're going to have a discussion. You can agree with me. You can disagree. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go over to Jerusalem. Michael, thanks so much for calling the Line of Fire. Have we spoken before on the phone from Jerusalem?
No, I don't believe we have.
All right, there was another general. It could have been David from Jerusalem, but I was actually broadcasting in Jerusalem when I spoke with, maybe it was David from Jerusalem. But Michael, thank you so much for the call.
You're very welcome, and I appreciate your ministry very much.
Thank you, sir.
I have quite a lot of people here who like to keep kosher, Gentiles and Christians. And I followed a discussion on your Facebook page as well, and a lot of people there are saying that the dietary laws were for health reasons. The question that raises in my mind is, why would God give all the unhealthy food to the Gentiles? He obviously loved the Gentiles. That's why he chose the Jews, was to bring the Messiah so that the Gentiles could come to know God as well. So that doesn't make much sense to me.
Right. It's a fair question. In other words, if the primary reason for the laws was dietary. Now, certainly, in the ancient world and in much of the world today, the animals that you can eat, a good number of them, are scavengers, are unclean, very unhealthy to eat pig products in many parts of the world, for example. There's argument that in a place like Louisiana, where people eat a lot of catfish, they have more health problems because of that catfish being scavengers. I'm no medical expert. These are just common arguments. But it's a fair question, Michael. If the laws were primarily given for dietary purposes, then God in his grace really should have made it a strong emphasis in the New Testament. And you kind of have the opposite emphasis in the New Testament. in terms of the food laws. Also, even though scholars have tried to demonstrate that all of the dietary laws are health-related, the fact is you can't do that consistently. In other words, you can with some animals or creatures, but not with all. And therefore, it is a rare, rare view. Really, hardly any scholars would hold to it, that the primary reason for the dietary laws was health-related. If people feel it's good to do for health purposes, go for it. Absolutely. But I think you raise a great point. By the way, Michael, where are you from originally?
England.
England. How long have you been in Jerusalem?
6 years.
6 years. Well, God bless you. May his grace and strength be yours in Jerusalem. Thanks so much for the call. We'll be right back. We're going to keep talking.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
All right. Did God command Peter to eat unclean food in Acts chapter 10? No, it was a symbolic vision. And what did it symbolize? That the gospel was now to go to the Gentiles, and Peter was not to consider them or call them unclean. And let's remember, as we debate and discuss dietary laws today, 866-34-TRUTH, as we do that, let's understand that Peter himself, here it is, Acts, the 10th chapter, he's still not eaten anything that would be considered unclean. So in other words, if there was this new release that all the followers of the Jewish followers of Yeshua just knew, hey, party time, now we're free from the dietary laws, let's eat whatever in the world we want to eat. Well, that obviously was not common knowledge for them, nor am I saying that God is calling people to violate the dietary laws. I'm simply saying that from a New Covenant perspective, they are not obligatory and they are not of great importance. The primary reason given for the dietary laws was to keep Israel separate from the nations and to teach principles of clean, unclean. When Yeshua deals with the question of eating with unwashed hands, does that defile you? In Matthew 15 and Mark 7, then he explains that which comes in from the outside does not defile, but that which comes out of the heart does. It's interesting that in both of those passages, then he immediately goes to Syrophoenicia. He immediately goes to a Gentile region and heals a woman's child who is terribly sick, a Gentile woman's child. There is a lesson there for us. 866-34-TRUTH. Mark, we lost Mark. Let's go to Shannon in Richmond, Virginia. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hello, Dr. Brown. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Wonderful. I was just calling to answer your question regarding are we under obligation to be under the law of food restriction as a Christian, as a Gentile Christian, and I say that no, we're not under obligation, because that obligation was a law which was written to the Israelites in the Old Testament. That was a covenant, and I believe where a lot of issue is today with our issues of belief, our issues of faith, are because we're not studying ourselves to understand the word and to be led by the Holy Spirit, and to have an understanding that there's a difference between the two covenant agreements. There are two covenant agreements. There's one covenant agreement, the old covenant, which was given to the Israelites, didn't even have anything to do with the Gentiles. We weren't a part of that covenant. But the new covenant, which is granted to us by the grace of Jesus because of his death and his resurrection, we're under that covenant now. And that covenant doesn't have us to be under the obligation of the law, which was given to the Israelites. We're under the covenant of grace and being under the leadership of the Holy Spirit.
So, right, so Shannon, you would then argue that if there's something that's important for us to know as a New Covenant believer, then that would be taught in the New Testament writings, that Paul would have addressed it or Peter would have addressed it, that it would have come up in the letters to the right. Gentile believers, whereas it's actually the reverse. Now, it was wrong when people aggressively taught people to eat unclean things and things sacrificed to idols. Jesus deals with that in Revelation 2, but Paul makes plain that if there was meat that was offered to an idol and you were served it and ate it, you didn't know it, that meat doesn't defile you. So if this was a new covenant emphasis, you'd expect to see something there, whereas in fact, we're told the opposite. Hey, Shannon, I'm with you on that. Let's see if someone can convince us otherwise. But thank you for the call. 866-34-TRUTH. You know, I posted this on Facebook. I posted it on Facebook the other day just to have a little fun and let people have a theological discussion, but also to demonstrate how passionate people get about this. It was also an object lesson that I could post about things far, far more important to our daily lives and get very little response, or some response. But post on this, and it seems to be a massively important issue to a lot of people on both sides, which to me is very interesting. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Charles in Nicholasville, Kentucky. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Sure. Thanks for having me. Sure enjoy your program. As a recovering Calvinist, I enjoy your debates with various people.
Thank you.
It's been a lot of fun. My question is circumcision. Genesis 17, and it's a bit of a theoretical question that perhaps has no answer, but why circumcision as the signal, signifying the covenant? Why? I'm wondering, growing a Jew, if you ever heard any rabbi, if there's anything in the Torah or anything about why that?
There are different theories about it. When I was raised in the Jewish home, it was nominal enough that it was not a subject that I even thought of asking, you know, why is it the sign of a covenant? But there's something very, very simple, all right? Very, very simple, which is this. Circumcision apparently was practiced in the land of Canaan. When God speaks about the uncircumcised Philistines, that caused them to stand out. They were outsiders. They were Aegean Sea peoples that came over to the land, and this was not part of their custom. So by taking on the covenant of circumcision, of course it had to do with progeny, it had to do with the seed and one's descendants and things like that, but it was also a joining with the land. In other words, this was now a covenant that tied in with the promise to give the land to the Jewish people, and therefore the covenant of circumcision was something that tied them in with a practice that was in the land. That's part of the reason. So again, progeny and destiny having to do with the male sexual organ, there's that image there. There are other connections in terms of the spiritual application of circumcising the heart. But it was part of what was done in the land of Canaan, from what we understand, and therefore it was a joining of the descendants of Abraham with the land of Canaan. Hey, Charles, got to run, but thank you for the call. 866-34-TRUTH. Oh, we've got some interesting calls we're going to get to on the other side of the break. Do you appreciate the work we're doing? Do you believe in our work to reach out to the lost sheep of the house of Israel? Do you believe in our work to help equip the church and awaken the church to God's purposes for Israel? If so, stand with us. Stand with us in this radio broadcast. This is a joint effort. We are listener-sponsored. Your gift of any size, I want to send you two DVDs with postage of $40 value. My debate with gay activist Harry Knox, who claims to be a born-again Christian, and my debate with Rabbi Shmuley about homosexuality and morality. Eye-opening debates. We recently showed some to some seminary students. They were shocked. Your gift of any size. So call right now. Would you do that? 1-800-278-9978. 1-800-278-9978. Once more, that's 1-800-278-9978.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome back, friends, to Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. I love live talk radio. Yeah, 2 hours a day in the midst of other teaching, schedule, ministry, writing. It's a challenge. In other words, life revolves around it, but it is a gift from God. I sit here sometimes just smiling, literally smiling with joy that I get to do this and speak with you and interact with you and agree and disagree on different points and be a voice of moral, cultural, spiritual revolution. This Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-348-7884. Shout out to everybody listening in Greater Charlotte. If you're listening on 960 AM or 105.7 FM, the Truth Radio Network, join me tonight at Southern Evangelical Seminary. Yikes, just 3.5 hours from now, and I got a lot to do before then. Okay, Southern Evangelical Seminary for directions, ses.edu. I'll be having a dialogue with Professor James Tabor. He heads up the religion department at UNC Charlotte. He is a well-known author, archaeologist. Well, he's done a lot of archaeological digs, Bible historian, controversial theories on a number of issues having to do with Paul and Jesus. We're going to have the pleasure of having a serious dialogue about that today. 866-34-TRUTH, 7 o'clock tonight. If you're a student with ID, so college, seminary student with ID, you get in for free. Otherwise, $10 admission at the door to help with the expenses of the event. By the way, when I was mentioning circumcision in answer to a question from the last caller, when I said it tied the Jewish people with the land, it was something practiced in the land. That's not a traditional Jewish answer, by the way. The traditional Jewish answer would emphasize the idea of progeny and seed and the sanctifying of the male sexual organ, which could be used for procreation but could be used in other evil ways in terms of giving oneself over to sinful desires, how every urge can be properly sanctified and given over to God. That would be more of a Jewish response. I mentioned part of that before the break. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Mark in Kingsborough, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling the line of fire.
How you doing, Dr. Brown?
Doing well, thanks.
First time, long time.
Well,
I have a question
you.
Here about Paleo Hebrew. I've heard a teaching where it talked about Hebrew started off as a pictograph and that the Hebrew letters had their own separate meanings and that the words were defined according to the meaning of the letters. Can you give me some insight on any of that?
Yeah, that's a complete myth. In fact, I just did a long interview about that with some other gentleman that I think was posted online today. As soon as we get a link, we'll put it on our website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org, or we'll post it on Facebook or tweet it out. It is true that the Phoenician script, from whence the Hebrew script comes, and by the way, from whence the Greek script comes, and then ultimately our English script, all goes back to that. Yes, originally was a pictograph. So, for example, Aleph, the first letter, was originally an ox head. Beit, right. The second letter, was originally by it, a house, and so on. So in Greek, you'd have Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet. In Hebrew, you'd have Aleph, Beit, Gimel, Dalet. In Greek, you'd have Alpha, Beta, Gamma, Delta. In English, you have A, B, C, D. This is the common origin of the alphabets. But by the time this language was, or this script was borrowed by the Israelites, because, again, Hebrew is a Canaanite dialect, Sfat Kanaan, the lip of Canaan, it's called in Isaiah 19. This was not an alphabet that our people developed. It was borrowed from the Phoenicians. By the time it was borrowed from the Phoenicians, a little over 3,000 years ago, it had lost all pictographic meaning. Just like the A in English does not mean ox head. It had lost all pictographic meaning. It is a complete myth, a total myth. This is a field of my PhD, Near Eastern Languages, a complete myth that the Hebrew, the ancient Hebrew script, can be interpreted by understanding the pictographs. Forget about it. Thanks for the call.
Send it, Lord.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
We started off discussing dietary laws. We started off 30-something minutes ago. I said that I do not believe that, based on the New Testament, that dietary laws are obligatory on followers of Jesus today, either Jewish or Gentile. I did not say that God is calling us to eat pork, all right? Did not advocate that. In my own life, I've never been a lobster shrimp eater. I don't eat ham sandwiches. I don't eat pepperoni pizza. So it's kind of immaterial in terms of my own life. However, that being said, I do not believe you can make any case scripturally, based on the New Testament, that we are obligated to keep the dietary laws today, in particular, Gentile believers. If you feel you have an argument against that, that's strong, fine. I'm glad to hear you out. Again, you may say, hey, I feel it's a good thing, or God must have given them for a good reason. Wonderful. You say, hey, as a Jewish believer, I feel it's important in solidarity with my people, or I'm personally convicted of it. Wonderful. But if you lay it on others or say others are called to, that's where I will take issue with you. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, let's go to Chicago, Illinois. We will go with your name you want to be called. So, Radical Moderate, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you very much, Dr. Brown. The question that I have is in regards, I guess, well, you gave the segue to it regarding dietary laws. And I've been thinking about this regarding the book, The Kosher Pig. Although I bought it, I still have not read it yet, but it is on my to-do list. But listening to the interview that you did with him in discussing this, that when the Messiah comes, he will return the pig to Israel. So my question, kind of not really gnawing, question is, well, does that mean since Jesus is the Messiah that the pig has actually now been made kosher?
No, this would be the argument. And of course, Sahih Sapir's book is coming under great criticism and controversy, and he is posting rebuttals to the various charges of the counter-missionaries, and the counter-missionaries are posting rebuttals to his rebuttals. And I'm doing my best at a certain point to weigh in more. Time just hasn't permitted me to do that. But the first thing is this. There is a discussion in some Jewish texts that in the world to come, even the pig will be kosher. Does that mean that dietary laws will be changed? Or does that mean that the pig will be physiologically altered so that it will now conform to being a clean animal? That's part of a debate. And then there are allusions in this way. The Yitzchak Shapira's argument is that the return of the kosher pig is a way of saying that that which was considered unclean in this world and the world to come will be considered clean. So the Jewish people rejecting Jesus the Messiah will in the future recognize him. They think he's unclean now. They'll recognize him as clean. And those have said that is a misuse of the text. So there's a lot of controversy surrounding it. But in any case, the more specific argument is this. Are there traditional Jewish texts that talk about a new Torah with the Messiah, or a new teaching or a new revelation with the Messiah, or a change in the dietary laws, etc.? If that's the case, then back to your question, does that mean that with the Messiah coming into the world, he introduces a new Torah? That's what can be debated. Does Jewish tradition support that or not? New Testament scholar W.D. Davies wrote a little book arguing in that very direction many years ago, and that would be, of course, the law of the Messiah, the new instructions that we have. Others have said, no, it just means, you know, new insights into the existing Torah. I get into some discussion about that in volumes 4 and 5 of Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. But in short, if the primary purpose of the Torah laws was to keep Jew and Gentile separate, and bear in mind that if you can't eat together, you can't do many, many things in life together. Just think of building a long-term relationship with someone that you want to marry, say, but under no circumstances can you ever enjoy a meal together. That makes it very difficult. Socializing, sharing lives together, intermarriage, even commerce becomes much more difficult. So this was constantly teaching Israel the difference between clean and unclean. And with the Messiah coming into the world, the distinction between Jew and Gentile, clean and unclean, that barrier is broken down in the Messiah. And then how that plays out with the dietary laws, that's the related debate. So that's kind of the long-winded answer to your question, but I appreciate the call. And as you're reading the book, be sure to follow the controversy and the responses back and forth as you have opportunity. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go over to Moscow. All right, we'll go to Moscow in a moment. Let's go over to Barry in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr.
Are you there,
Brown?
Barry? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm calling to ask you how you would respond to, well, let me put it this way. The difference that I have with you is that is a matter of identity with the Jewish people. For a Jewish believer to keep, you know, the law to an extent, you know, according to Jeremiah 31, 35 through 37, that we're to remain a people. So how do we remain a people if we don't, you know, identify with our people either through the feasts or through the law? And in the New Testament, you know, it talks about in Acts 21, where it says that all the elders of the, you know, the church, and including Paul, were zealous for the law and the customs and walked orderly according to the law. Not to say that they, you know, were had to do different things, but they kept it to identify with the Jewish people.
Right. Yes. Very much a strong argument. Acts 21, Jacob, James points out to Paul that there are myriads of thousands, tens of thousands of Jews in Jerusalem who are all zealous for the law. And they wanted Paul to demonstrate that he was not teaching Jews to violate the law of Moses. And Paul went ahead and did that. So I number one, have no argument with Jewish believers feeling that calling to identify in that respect. Bear in mind, the bulk of American Jews do not keep the dietary laws. So the bulk of American Jews, even for those who feel that it's important to identify as Jews, they are not keeping dietary laws. So there are many, many ways to identify as Jews without the dietary laws. There are many, many ways to identify as Jews without the feasts. There are, you know, it's,
well,
my Jewish identity doesn't, go ahead.
Isn't that the basis, though, that how we remain a distinct people, you know, as believers? We're, you know, we're still Jews, but we're one with the body, Jews and Gentiles, but we still are Jews, like Paul was. You know, he didn't say I was a Jew, he said I am a Jew. And so isn't, how else do we, you know, remain, keep our identity as Jews?
All right, so here's the question then. If this is obligatory, then are you celebrating and following each new moon, for example? Because that's
no,
tough.
But no, and I'm not saying that, you know, and we're not going to go around stoning people either, but no.
But why dietary laws and feasts? I mean, isn't that arbitrary?
Well, I'm saying basically the feasts. And, you know, you could say it's arbitrary, but
right. I mean, that's the issue. I have no problem whatsoever, with Jewish believers feeling called to this, feeling covenantally called to it. But there's an interesting point that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians 7. He says, if you're saved and you're circumcised, don't become uncircumcised, right? If you're saved and you're uncircumcised, don't become circumcised. Continue to live in the calling you had. So Jews living one way, Gentiles living another way. What if when you were saved, you were a Jewish person that did not keep the dietary laws. When you're saved, you're a Jewish person that did not keep the feast. Do you now put them on and begin to do these things that you never did before because you're Jewish, or is that the opposite of what Paul was discussing? So let me say two things, and then I've got to break, Barry. Number one, I understand how the arguments from Acts can be used, and those are powerful arguments. I just do not see them reinforced through the rest of the New Testament in a prescriptive way. But if someone does feel that calling, especially as a Jewish believer, for identity purposes and transmission to the next generation, fine. But the other thought, the question is, how do you then decide which? Seems arbitrary to say dietary laws and feasts. Why just those? All right, thank you, sir, for the discussion.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Thanks again, friends, for joining us on The Line of Fire on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you missed my interview with Waleed Shubat the first hour, I encourage you to listen by going to my website, askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. And we got into a lot of controversial issues. Love to hear your thoughts on it. I appreciate his passion and putting his life on the line for the things he stands for. 866-34-TRUTH. All right, let's go over to Moscow. We were in Jerusalem earlier. Let's go to Moscow. Sirdar, thanks for joining us on the Line of Fire today.
Hi there, Dr. Brown. How are you, sir?
Good. It's good to hear from you. Hey, can I ask you a quick question before we get to your question?
Sure, sir. Of course.
Okay. As a follower of Jesus in Russia, when you see the stance that Vladimir Putin has taken on certain family issues or the law against gay propaganda for minors or about homosexual couples adopting kids and things like that, and then him lecturing the West, do you see him doing this as a truly Christian man? Do you see him doing this simply for pragmatism in his nation? Do you see him as still having KGB roots, or do you see him as a changed man? I know it's just your opinion, but there in Russia, just curious to know your thoughts.
Well, first of all, as a Christians, we're of course sure that the stance that actually his view in this regard is based on the biblical values.
Yes,
that family is a family as such, as the Bible dictates. I mean, as the Bible says it. Well, mm-hmm. I don't think this is just because of the KGB background or something. I think this is Russian roots. This is what I think. And in this regard, we as Christians really share this value as well. We're glad that our president shared this as well.
Got it. All right. And as far as your knowledge of him as a Christian or Russian Orthodox, what do you understand? Does he have a testimony of any kind?
Testimony of any kind. Well, as far as you know, he himself got divorced last year. Well, this is his personal life, and this is his responsibility before him and God.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not only a family man himself; he's also a person with a tremendous responsibility before the whole nation. One of the great nations of the world, actually.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, in this regard, so again, as I say, so we're glad that he's sticking to, at least he's professing this values of,
yes.
Well, biblical example of family.
And how do you feel in Russia when America, with all of our moral decadence, lectures Russia? How does that make you feel there in your country?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I understand, sir. Well, first of all, because we're living in the world where the information exchange goes very fast. So, and we as Christians understand here in Russia that what is going on in America and in the West in terms of spiritual decadence, families, redefinition and so on, this may also come here as well. This is just a matter of time if we do not pray for that, against that. So, because there are actually a lot of people who also share this view as in America. I mean, LGBT people and so on, but they're not so open here as in the United States and in the West.
Right.
And so they're not allowed here to have to demonstrate themselves the way they are allowed in the West. So, and we as Christians, again, so we need to pray that this never really happens and does not influence our children.
Got it. All clear. All right. So thank you for your comments. What was your question for me, sir?
Sir. Yeah. Well, this is actually a question of myself and my wife. So we have three children, small children, the eldest one being 5 years of age, and he already asks about Nazis. About this stories about, this bad stories about Nazis and fascism, you know. So, and we just wanted to ask you your opinion. When do you think it's relevant for a small child, at what age, to be introduced to the history of Nazism, to the history of Holocaust, in terms of not to damage this, you know?
Obviously, it's important to understand that there are evil people in the world who do evil things, and it's important for that child to understand that, to the extent he can, God's choosing of Jewish people in history and hatred towards Jews and Jesus himself being Jewish. Obviously, some of these concepts can be better understood, but you don't want to spook him. You know, you don't want him to go to sleep having nightmares. You need him to know God's love and that daddy's there for him and all of those things, which, of course, you understand as a father. But I don't think it's too young to say that when people reject God and reject his truth, they become full of hate and do terrible, terrible, terrible things. And then, to the extent that he can handle some of the information, you make further information available to him. So that's the way I would approach it. You know your own child. Don't feel the need to try to make him understand the full weight of things, but that he needs to understand that these people hated men, women, and children and did very terrible things. And that's what happens when we reject God and his truth. And then again, as he's able to understand more, then you give him more information. That's practical. So, and then to the extent he can relate to another child or another little boy, or this happened to a little girl, then it's helpful rather than statistics. But again, do it in a way that does not give him nightmares or put him in any sense of personal terror. Hey, I've got to run, but I did want to take your call, and I wish you God's grace there in Russia. Friends, if you appreciate the work that we are doing on the front lines of Jewish ministry, and many unique roles we're called to play, stand with us. We could really use your help. We are listener-sponsored. Call right now, 1-800-278-9978. Why not become a torchbearer? Why not become a monthly supporter? Your gift of just putting aside $1 a day goes a long way for our ministry. And as a torchbearer, we send you a new message every month. We give you free access to our online classes. We give you a discount in our online bookstore. It's a great way for you to stand with us, help us in the process. Call right now, 1-800-278-9978, 1-800-278-9978, or go to AskDrBrown.org, click donate. My bottom line today, we might divide on the issue of the dietary laws, but whatever our view, let us keep Jesus the Messiah central.